Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our June Artist of the Month, Dan Vapid, is a punk rock musician whose tenures in bands such as the Methadones, the Riverdales, Screeching Weasel, the Queers, Sludgeworth, and Noise by Numbers make him one of pop punk's most prolific players. Most recently, he's formed a project called Dan Vapid and the Cheats, whose two albums to date have showcased his muscular but melodic songwriting. Shortly after a show last month at Chicago's Reggie's Rock Club, where Dan played a set with his legendary side project The Mopes, and I performed as guitarist with The Parasites, we set up a phone interview about Dan's extensive career, a conversation we'll be hearing over the next hour. Right now we're listening to a track from the first Mopes EP, 1998's Lowdown 2-Bit Sidewinder, called Loopy Cockatoo. And we'll continue with a track from Dan Vapid and the Cheats' self-titled 2012 debut album, released on the band's own Torture Chamber Records, called Torture Chamber.
That I was a fan of with Kiss, the guy that he lived across the street from me, and he played me Kiss and David Bowie at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I really liked Kiss a lot. Then he played me David Bowie, and I really liked David Bowie.
That's a very makeup heavy introduction to rock and roll.
Yeah, so I was about 5 years old, and then the kid down the street, probably the next day, he said, "Well, have you ever heard the Beatles?" I said, "No, are they anything like Kiss?" And he said, I actually said that, I was fine. And he said, "Well, yeah, kind of, sort of. They have a song called I Want to Hold Your Hand, and it's a pretty cool song. You should hear it." And I said, "Okay." So I went over to his house, and I thought it was really hokey.
Okay.
I said, "This isn't like Kiss at all." I thought it was pretty hokey and everything. So maybe fast forward maybe about a week or 2 weeks after that, and there was a guy that lives down the street who ironically... I tell this story every once in a while, and it's pretty funny. But ironically, he's the guy that designed the Screeching Weasel logo, the Weasel logo.
Mm-hmm.
He lived around the corner from me.
And where did you grow up, by the way?
I grew up in Des Plaines, Illinois.
Oh, okay.
So he lived on the next block from me, and he had the first Kiss album. And he said, "Hey, I have the first Kiss album." I said, "Well, yeah, let's go and listen to it." He was probably about 8. I was about 5.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember distinctly being at his house in his living room and listening to that first Kiss album. And I fell in love with it. I loved it.
Right.
From there, I got into bands like AC/DC. I got into bands, even like, you know, any rock band, Rush, some of those bands from the 70s. You know, 1980 came around. I started hearing stuff like Cheap Trick, Off-Broadway, The Knack, you know, bands like that were on the radio.
Like the 21st century power pop riot kind of stuff?
Yeah, I liked this stuff. I thought it was pretty cool, but I started hearing heavy metal, and I thought heavy metal was cooler.
Mm-hmm.
So then Judas Priest followed, and Iron Maiden, and so I got into all that stuff.
Yeah, you're probably less likely to be beaten up if you're wearing a Scorpion shirt than, like, an Elvis Costello shirt.
Right, I was really into the Scorpion. I liked the stuff, but it was a weird thing. I'd seen, you know, they had, like, Hit Parader magazine, and, you know, at the grocery store, and I would see these ads, and they would have Metallica on them, and I'm like, who is this band? So eventually I heard, it was probably in sometime in 1983, I had heard Metallica, and I heard Raven, and some of these underground metal bands, and I thought they were pretty cool. Now, those guys were wearing hardcore shirts, Metallica. You would see the pictures of them, and they would have a Misfit shirt, mm-hmm. or they would have a Discharge shirt, and I would say, whoa, who's this?
Right.
Okay, so I was curious about that. Well, on accident, one night, some friends of mine, we were listening to the radio, and we had caught something called Fast and Loud, which was the radio station over in Evanston, out of the school there in Evanston.
Oh, the Northwestern one?
At Northwestern, yeah. And so there was a show every Saturday night called Fast and Loud. This was about 1984. And we started hearing the stuff just on accident. And then finally put two and two together and figured out, oh, hey, we had kind of discovered hardcore one, and I had discovered hardcore. I really, really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I had gotten to hardcore, I was hearing bands like, you know, Minor Threat, 7 Seconds. And then from there, I started hearing more of the early punk rock stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Ramones, Naked Raygun. Okay, now, at that point, I think I finally found what I was trying to look for my whole life. You know, mm-hmm. because I wanted that punchy sound that bands like Kiss and the Scorpions had, but there was something that was kind of a miss, and even some of the heavy metal stuff I was kind of listening to.
Mm-hmm.
And it just had those hooks, and it had some kind of sensibility that I couldn't put my finger on when I was young.
Right.
That was kind of the stuff that made me want to be in a band, was the Ramones and Naked Raygun.
From a 1992 cover of the Ramones' first album, here's Screeching Weasel with Dan on lead vocals doing Let's Dance.
Hey baby, won't you take a chance? Tell the girl let me have a dance. So let's dance, let's dance. We'll do the Christmas shop and my say let's go. Any other dance you wanna do. Let's dance, let's dance. Hey baby, oh you threw my soul. Pull me tight, don't you let me go.
I was in a hardcore band in 1987 called Generation Waste, but when I was in the band, I really, really wanted to be in more of a melodic punk band, mm-hmm. where most bands that were playing more straight-up hardcore, which is what I kind of was my introduction, but I kind of discovered the more earlier sound and really liked that stuff more. And from there, it was just evolution. And then with the Ramones and bands like Naked Raygun, then I would say, well, who are they listening to? You know, with
yeah.
the Ramones, of course, that led back to the 60s. It led back to all the early rock and roll stuff. It went through that whole phase. And then, you know, you read about those artists. You know, who were they into? A lot of them were in the country, you know, like, oh, you know, Hank Williams and Johnny Cash and stuff like mm-hmm. that. I investigated all that. And then I started getting back into the, like, man, you know, there were some good tunes kind of going on when I was like 10, but I was just a little more into metal at the time. And I started getting back into those songs, like from Cheap Trick and Off Broadway and The Knack and The Kings.
Right.
So I started investigating that genre. And it's just all of it really comes down to just having a love for music. And even the funny part is that then I went full circle with the Beatles. Now I love the Beatles. When I was five, I didn't like them. It's kind of a funny story how it took me probably till I was about maybe 21, 22 years old to kind of like the Beatles. By the time I was 25, I really liked them a lot.
You took the scenic route.
I took the scenic route with them. What got me into them was were the deep cuts. Because, like I said, some of the songs like Help and 8 Days a Week, they were kind of a turnoff when I was growing up. You know, now they don't bother me. My gateway was more of a song like Bad Boy or I'm Down or, some of those early songs. And that kind of turned into what it did, you know. But the tastes have always evolved my whole life, you know, since I was just a little kid up until even now. I mean, I'm always kind of going through some kind of musical phase. And I think what I'm most known for is the pop punk phase.
Right.
It's not all the phase. None of them are actually phases because I still can go back and find stuff that I still like. You know, I go back and listen to that AC/DC record or Kiss record. I still like it. You know what I mean? What I got known for was for my love of the Ramones and Naked Reagan and the bands that were inspired by that. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a long story, but it starts there. And, you know, it's going to continue probably until I die, you know. I just keep discovering things. I guess it's just what happens when you love music.
When did you first join Screeching Weasel?
I joined Screeching Weasel in 1989. We had done a tour, and when we got back, I recorded a 7-inch called Punk House, and I did another like a 10-inch with a label called Very Small Records. We had done a tour. We did it with no equipment. We just had our guitars, and we kind of borrowed equipment on the way up. We went to like the West Coast and down like near Arizona, and it was really kind of a messed up tour. Went all the way to Florida. By the time we got back home, we just ended up breaking up. But
okay.
It wasn't for very long. When we got back together, probably like a year later or something like that. But when we had broken up is when I started a band called Sludgeworth.
Okay.
And we did that band, and then Screeching Weasel got back together, and I did both bands for a while.
Were you writing for both bands?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. With co-writing for both bands. Some of the Sludgeworth stuff I wrote on my own, but most of it was collaborative work with the other guys. Usually, like, one of the guys would have a riff or something, and I would make a song out of it or something like that. With Screeching Weasel, it was kind of a similar thing. I would just show Ben an idea, and he could usually turn it into something, or, you know, if he wasn't into it, we would just skip it. But so, yeah, I kind of collaborated with both of those bands, and, you know, with Sludgeworth, you know, wrote some of the songs from start to finish, but most of it was collaborative.
Okay. From Sludgeworth's 1991 album, What's This?, later compiled on the 1995 collection, Losers of the Year, here's a track called Someday.
Oh,
being in Sludgeworth and Screeching Weasel at the same time, was it ever hard getting the schedules to line up?
No, I would say the scheduling wasn't a problem. There was always a little, not outward jealousy, but there was always some kind of little, I mean, I could feel it from both bands. It was always kind of like, oh, you're going to play with the other band, huh? You know what I mean? Like, you know, there was always that little kind of slight, I don't know if resentment is the right word, but and I don't know if it was just a thing of just being young, too. I mean, everybody was, like, around 20 years old at the time, and, you know, I think, you know.
Communication skills aren't 100% developed at that point.
Yeah, I think sometimes bands are kind of like girlfriends. You got four girlfriends, you know, so you're going out with the other girlfriend, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird thing, but there's a little bit of truth to that, and in my experience, and a lot of other people in bands will tell you the same. So there was a little bit of that. Scheduling, not so much.
Okay.
We managed to make that stuff work.
What was the first album where you were starting to notice more people in the audience that, like, you didn't know?
Like, when I looked out in the crowd, I didn't know the people that were in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
I would definitely say, you know, sometime in 1990 that was the case, but definitely what I really saw it the most was with Screeching Weasel, My Brain Hurts.
Okay.
We had put that record out, and then the shows were getting bigger. And I think it was just at that time, too. You know, Green Day were pretty young at the time, and they were playing, and there was, you know, bands like NoFX, you know, just kind of starting out. And you can kind of see this thing happen in the suburbs where, you know, beforehand, most of the shows were going on in Chicago at the time, probably in the late 80s. By there, like 1990, 91, like there was a club out in the west suburbs called McGregor's, and that was the club that was kind of, you would see more kids coming out like each show, and some of the Screeching Weasel shows, I mean, they were getting to be pretty big.
Right.
I would say I really started noticing it around that time period.
Okay.
For both bands, for Sludgeworth too, and Sludgeworth was doing really well in the early 90s as well. Because I know what you're saying, there'd be a point where you would look out and it would be all your friends.
Yeah.
I remember thinking that was a bad sign back then, you know, and then, you know, it got to the point where like a few friends are up front and then most people were unknown, and I felt like, okay, this is a good sign.
Yeah.
And not because I didn't want my friends there. Of course, I did want my friends there. It's just, you know, I want people that I didn't know to be responding to what we were doing, and they were. So it would have been around that time period.
Up next, we'll hear Screeching Weasel with a track that Dan wrote for the band from 1993's Wiggle, called I Was a High School Psychopath.
History. I wanna blow up my high school and take my
towards the middle of the 90s, Screeching Weasel broke up, and the Riverdales started up, with, again, you and Ben sort of leading the charge. What was behind starting a new band rather than doing a Screeching Weasel album with, say, more of a Ramones-y feel?
Well, Ben and I kind of we've had a couple falling outs over the years.
Okay.
The first time that we did, I got to get into this whole story. Well, okay, I had been touring with the Queers a lot.
Yeah.
But there was a point where we were drinking a lot, and he thought I was giving the band a bad name. You know, he came back and he said, "I feel like you've had more than your fair share of drink. You either stop drinking, or you're out of the band." And I was like, "All right, well, I'll leave."
Mm-hmm.
So I had left, and you know, I'd asked my parents, I'd asked my brother, you know, my girlfriend at the time, other close friends. I said, "Are you concerned at all about this? If you are, just tell me." They said, "No, we're not concerned. I know you had a few. It's not like something I'm concerned about. I don't believe you're an alcoholic. I think he's way off base by even saying that and giving you this ultimatum. I think he just wants to tell you what to do," and I agreed. And so I thought I made the right choice. And so after that, maybe about a week or two later, I realized that they'd got Mike Dirnt from Green Day to play on their record. I'm like, "Oh, okay." Then I really felt like I was pushed out, you know what I mean? Okay.
Yeah.
Try to nudge me out to get somebody with that has a big name and play on your record and maybe you'll sell more records. Well, it didn't work for them, but that's what happened. Fast forward maybe about a year, I just ended up quitting drinking on my own. He had found out about it. He had said to me, "You know, hey, I'm looking to do a new band. Would you want to do a band with me?" And I said, "Well, you know, I told him that I really just want to sing the songs that I'm writing." He's like, "Well, how about if I sing the songs I write and you sing the songs you write?" And I said, "Okay, let's give it another shot." So the way I looked at it was like, "All right, you know, let's just let bygones be bygones. Fuck it."
Mm-hmm.
Get back. So we started playing again. And from there, we were on and off up until 2009, but we were gone for a good amount of years there.
Mm.
We had began in, I'd say, 1994 with our first record. At Storm the Streets in 95, and then, well, maybe the Storm the Streets was 97. Jeez, I think I'm getting these dates wrong. But then the early 2000s had Phase 3, and then 2008 had Invasion USA, and then Tarantula was in 2009. So there's a big gap between those.
Okay. From the second Riverdale's album, 1997's Storm the Streets, this is the classic Riverdale Stomp. in the late 90s, you did the Mopes, which is sort of like a pop punk supergroup, because everyone mm-hmm. in that band had been in a notable project beforehand.
Yeah, what had happened was we were on tour with the Queers, and at that point, we were listening to a lot of novelty, like groupie greats from like the 60s. Mm-hmm. We'd have a lot of downtime, so we'd just start playing and just coming up with like these silly songs that were inspired by that. And so we just it kind of just took a life of its own from that. I thought, like, hey, why don't we do just one little EP inspired from that kind of genre and then just kind of move on? And it was cool. I mean, it was a thing, like, at the time, that seemed pretty cool. Like, looking back now, I'm kind of go, I don't regret it or anything, but it's not my, like, my favorite thing I've done. Mm-hmm. You know, it was honest at the time for what we were feeling. And, yeah, we just decided to do, like, a fun record in honor of the goofy, great-esque songs from the 60s and just kind of roll with that. Mm-hmm. And then after we had done that, you know, a lot of people were asking, hey, you know, we should do another record. I had a bunch of songs written. I was like, okay. Well, what the hell? So I had probably about half of that Accident Waiting to Happen record. Mm-hmm. I just started coming up with a lot more like instrumentals based around the spaghetti westerns, like those Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns. Just kind of inspired from that and just kind of combined that and made Accident Waiting to Happen.
Hearing those songs played live, they really hold up very well.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you.
Here are the Mopes with the track from their only full-length album, 1999's Accident Waiting to Happen, called I Don't Know How to Say Goodbye.
This isn't easy for me to do. I keep holding back and I don't know why. I still haven't broke the news to you. I just don't.
People say that some things are not meant to be.
The first Methadones album had you, B-Face, and Lumley, a very similar lineup to the Mopes. Was there ever a thought to make that Ill at Ease album another Mopes album, or did you have a different concept for what Methadones was?
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of written a lot of songs, and, once a band starts in one kind of style or direction, and you start writing something else that's kind of nothing like the other thing, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really sound like the Mopes to me.
Yeah.
I have a whole new batch of songs here. They're kind of dark. They're introspective at parts. They're totally different vibe than the Mopes. You know, just at the time, I wanted to do a record and just kind of go in a different direction. So I recruited those guys, and we had made that record. And after that record, I got a lineup, like a full-time lineup, with the guys that I still, had till the end.
Do you usually target your songwriting to a specific project?
You know, in general, I try not to do that too much.
Yeah.
I try to be flexible about it. I try not to paint myself in a corner too much. But at the same time, I don't want somebody to hear it and go, wow, this is night and day, you know?
Yeah.
Which would have happened if that Ill at Ease record was under the Mopes name. Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't have been the same. But to answer your question, I try not to. I try to be flexible about it and just let things come out naturally and not try to force them too much.
Yeah.
And, in doing that, you're going to get different things coming out.
Sure.
At least I do,
Here's the leadoff track from that first Methadones album, 2000's Ill at Ease, called Solitude. My favorite Methadone song is Getting Older, Losing Touch. It's like one of the best songs about feeling disconnected from your audience. Was that sort of an autobiographical thing you were going through at the time?
Oh, sure was. Yeah. I was with a friend of mine who happens to be in a huge, huge band now called Rise Against, and we were at the Warped Tour. And he was just starting up at the time, and he kind of knew a lot of the people that were playing, and I kind of had fallen out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, there was a lot of things that had changed, but that had been changing, you know, since pretty much like Green Day had broke. But I'd seen the momentum just keep going and going and going. And so this was like right around probably the year 2000, I think. I'd seen things to the point where, you know, I can remember, for example, and I know a lot of people really like this band, but I remember seeing AFI, and every single stage move the guy had was exactly to the T like Glenn Danzig. You know, and I'm like, well, I've seen Sam Hain before. it was just little things that, like, there was nothing new about it to me, and just it was kind of just being recycled and rebranded. And just, I mean, I can go on forever about that, but to answer your question, to sum it all up, yeah, it's very autobiographical. And I felt like I wasn't really relating in a lot of ways. And sometimes I still don't.
Do you think of pop punk as sort of like a young man's game, or?
I don't know. I've been feeling like an outsider from it for kind of a while now. I just kind of do my thing. In a lot of ways, I don't, but in a lot of ways, I kind of do as well. I mean, at the end of the day, I just kind of just do my thing.
Right.
I'm honest about it. I just try to write songs that I think I would want to hear if I weren't in the band, and let the chips fall.
From 2007's This Won't Hurt, here are the Methadones with Getting Old, Losing Touch. Is there a difference in approach having your name out front?
Is there a difference in the approach of what?
Well, in a lot of respects, like the songwriting doesn't seem to be targeted specifically in the same way that you were mentioning before. And I mean, you're also self-releasing these on your own label, so you have like full control of the finished product as well.
Yeah, with this project, it was more I had done kind of the niche writing thing a little bit. Like I said, I always try to be flexible, but I would find, like, I didn't want to paint myself in the corner too much, but I would always find myself like, okay, I have a song that's nothing like the Methadone. Mm-hmm. I have a song that's nothing like the Mopes. And I still have tons of them. I've never released, you know, they've just been sitting there, some for years.
Right.
I don't know what to do with them. You know, I get an idea and I flush it out and I enjoy the process of doing it. So that's why I do it. But then sometimes I don't know what to do with it.
Right.
I'm like, okay, well, I have this song here. Where do I put it? With this project, what I wanted to do was just say, hey, if it sounds like a Screeching Weasel song, that's fine. It sounds like a Mopes Riverdale song, that's fine. It sounds like whatever. Just, I wanted to be like even a little more flexible about musical styles and doing the niche writing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been approaching it kind of in that way. We have two records. I imagine the third record will probably sound a lot different to a lot of people.
I'm looking forward to that. Particularly on the second record, there are a lot of songs that just seem like they're trying a lot of new, interesting musical things. I really like Cold and Rainy Nights. It's got kind of a Beach Boys-y vibe to it, to my ear.
Yeah, that's like a 60s influence, you know. There's just kind of just trying to allow yourself to have that flexibility. So I'm trying to do that more with this new band. You know, I don't know. At the end of the day, I just want to hear. I don't really care what genre is. You know, I just want to hear a good song. I really do. You know, I don't really care what it sounds like. If it has a lot of guitars, if it has a jangly guitar, if it has an acoustic guitar, if it has, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care. You know, I just want a well-written song and something that's going to stick with me.
Sure.
That's it. That's my goal.
From 2013's Dan Vapid and the Cheats 2, here's the song I referred to earlier, although I did get the title slightly wrong, called Cold and Rainy Days.
Let's watch the sunrise. Everything's gonna be okay. You'll discover that you can recover from the one who slipped away. Throw your arms around the world. Go and find another.
It seems that in recent years you've been a little more open to like reunions, and when I first saw you, you were doing a Riverdale set with the Lillingtons backing you up, and more recently you did
right.
the Mopes reunion show, and a couple years ago there was a Sledgeworth reunion. It seems like you're comfortable with your musical history in a way.
Yeah, and I would do the same with the Methadones again. You know, the Methadones just did something at the Red Scare Fest back in October.
Okay.
We would do a one-off. I think with all those bands that you just talked about, is there was a time where, not really with the Mopes, but with the Methadones there was, and the Riverdales, and Sledgeworth, there was a time where, you know, you would rehearse, you know, once a week, twice a week,
mm-hmm.
You would play every show you could. You would put out as many records as you could. You know, you were trying to get somewhere with your band. And with those bands, it's not really the thing anymore. You know, I feel like a lot of those bands just kind of ran their course, especially with the Methadones. I feel that way the most with the Methadones. I really went 10 years with that band and a lot of tours, and, you know, we did 5 records. So, but I felt like we had got to that point. And so everybody in the Methadones still gets along really well. Same with the Mopes. But there is just not really that drive to keep going as a band, like most bands do, you know, where you're rehearsing once a week and doing all these tours and you're on that whole thing. That's just not there. So getting up and playing some of the old songs, I'm totally fine with that. I actually think it's weird when bands have issues about it.
Yeah.
Unless you think the songs totally suck, I don't know what the issue is. I mean, I see that every once in a while. Our band's like, I will not do a reunion. I'm like, is it like shame or something, you know? I think a lot of artists don't like doing reunions because, you know, they want to stay current or whatever. I understand that too, but you can do both.
Right.
So I don't mind playing old songs, but it doesn't mean I'm going to. I don't live in the past, you know. I still want to create new memories and, you know, and release new music, and hopefully people respond to it.
Here are the Riverdales with a catchy track from 2009's Invasion USA called Heart Out of Season.
Do you just keep like a journal of ideas, or do you have to sit yourself down and try and come up with something?
There's a lot of ways that I think you can write a song, and I think there's really no rules in how to write a song. I just think you have to make it work in the end.
Right.
So what usually happens is I have an idea, like a chorus or something will pop into my head, and I kind of feel it out from there and kind of see where it's going to go, what it's about. And just kind of go with what the vibe that had entered my head. And I think that's the best way of doing it a lot of the times, because I think sometimes when you sit down and you grab your guitar and you try to write a song, what happens is that your hands want to move in the same direction. The last time you picked up that guitar, there's just something that happens with a lot of musicians, and it's really bad for songwriting to break out of that. So when you think of it before you actually put your hands to the instrument, it usually breaks you out of that routine of wanting to go to certain chords or whatever the situation is, or strumming patterns or whatever. I also think it's a good idea to try to write songs on different instruments.
Okay.
If you're a guitar player, pick up a bass. Bass player, pick up a guitar.
Yeah.
Even tap out a beat on a drum if you can't play a piano. Play a couple notes on a piano. You'd be surprised at what can kind of just trigger something.
Right. You know, it's just a way of surprising yourself, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think the best songs are usually the ones that are written when there's not an instrument around or when you're just not trying to write a song at all.
Sure.
You know, I think if you're going, okay, I need something, you pick up your instrument and you try to do it, a lot of times it just sounds forced.
Right.
You know, so I am a believer that most of the best songs are written pretty quickly, about 80% maybe within, you know, under 30 minutes, maybe the other 20% may take you a month, but you catch my drift. Like, you get the gist of it pretty fast.
Right.
I tend to think the best songs are written that way as well. So, and then, you know, some people will write lyrics first and kind of put it to music. I tend to think that, you know, writing in that way feels slapped on and not, so there isn't a good marriage between the two. I think if the music has kind of a dark feel, it's probably a good thing that the lyrics are also dark. If the music kind of has an upbeat feeling, I think the lyrics should have an upbeat feeling. I think those things need to come together. I'm a right. believer in that as well. Not always. Sometimes it's great to have the exact opposite, and it'll have a great effect.
Yeah.
But I think most of the time, those two parts need to have a good marriage. I think that's what a good song also should do, you know, and to not overthink it and just let things come naturally.
Up next, we'll hear Noise by Numbers with a track from their 2009 debut album, Yeah Whatever, called Waiting for the Train.
Just sit there and do not
watch people on the streets,
on the, streets.
The places that they meet,
places that they
so many faces I'll never see again. Passing Logan Square, I always see you there with a stack of pamphlets at your feet, waiting for the train, waiting for the train. Waiting for that train. Waiting for that train. The blue line in Jefferson Park. He'd like to keep warm. But no, I fall like a shower of sparks. Skip through the sun times. Remember the magic is signed. The big red lips begin to me. Thoughts of Wicker Park before it was gentrified. That old flat where punk bands used to play. Waiting for the train. Waiting for the train. Waiting for the train. Waiting for the train. Get a sentimental feeling. Even if memories lie, somehow it feels so great. Somehow it feels so real inside. Waiting for it.
That the newest release that you've put out is the new Noise by Numbers EP.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that project has the furthest departure from the pop-punk wheelhouse.
Well, that last EP that you heard was actually started as like a demo.
Okay.
It's actually pretty old. It's like maybe 3 or 4 years old. We had done it over a weekend, and it was just shelved for a while, and okay. Our guitar player really wanted to put it out. You know, I was like, oh, okay, you know, pretty much what it was, but it was supposed to just be a demo. We were going to do another record, and we didn't. We ended up breaking up.
Okay.
But that band is just guys that I know that, you know, we have the same love for, like, Husker Du,
right,
and, like, Naked Ray Gun.
I mean, I hear a little bit of Replacements in there as well.
Yeah, yeah. It was more of that side that I'm kind of not really known for, but I really like. You know, most people kind of know me for more of the Ramones, you know, influence.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I like a lot more bands than the Ramones, and I always have, you know.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of exploring that a little more than I had in previous years. And so, you know, I've known the guitar player for a long time, and then I had known the bass player as well. And the drummer I just had met through Jeff, the guitar player. And they started playing, you know. Oh, wait a minute. Actually, we started with Neil from the Lawrence Sounds. That's right. He had played for a little while. He played a couple shows with us, and then we got Jimmy Lucido, because Neil had, like, a lot of things going on. And, you know, Jimmy was really excited to do it and everything, so, so that was that project. Yeah, a lot of projects.
It's good to diversify. Keeps you busy. Although, you do seem to be very busy apart from music. You're a father.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you say that being a father is your full-time job more than music?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, easily. Being a father takes up a lot of your time.
And that's what I hear.
A lot of work. Yes, it is.
These days, is it more hard to find time to conduct band business and just do rehearsals? And
I'm glad you asked that. That's a really good question, actually. And it is. Before I had kids, it was a lot easier to be in a band. Now, I have put out 2 records since my son was born. He's 4 now. He just turned 4. But I also have a 3-month-old, and I've been finding doing this 3rd record to be really difficult, time-wise. Just trying to line everything up. The logistics of it has been pretty, pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get there, but, you know, hopefully sooner than later. But, you know, I will get there. I'm just saying it's been harder, you know, and having kids is definitely pretty tough in terms of that, at least like on the level that I'm doing it at, you know.
Sure. But the music is really good, and so it's a pleasure to listen to a lot of it, and it was a pleasure to talk to you.
All right, well, I appreciate that. Thanks, man.
Oh, thanks for agreeing to do this.
Yeah, no problem.
I'll try and make it out to the next time that she's playing Chicago.
All right, right on. I appreciate that. Thank you for the interview.
All right, thanks again, Dan.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's all the time we have for this week's episode. I'd like to thank Dan once again for taking time out of his busy parental schedule to talk to Stereo Hysteria. And if you liked any of the music you heard over the last hour, head over to torturechamberrecords.bandcamp.com, where you can purchase albums by Dan Vapid and the Cheats and the Mopes, as well as a remixed version of the Methadone's Not Economically Viable album. Be sure to tune in again next week, when we'll be hearing a selection of songs about the sun. This is Charlie, signing off.